considering I'd been through the routine before. 23. Everything with Kitsy had pushed Boris's visit temporarily from my mind, but once I went to sleep, it all came back sideways in dreams. Twice I woke, bolt upright. Once from a door swinging open nightmarishly into the storage locker, while kerchiefed women fought over a pile of used clothes outside. Then, drifting back asleep into a different staging of the same dream, storage unit as flimsy curtained space open to the sky, billowing walls of fabric not quite long enough to touch the grass. Beyond was a prospect of green fields and girls in long white dresses, an image fraught mysteriously with such death-charged and ritualistic horror that I woke gasping. I checked my phone. 4 a.m. After a miserable half hour, I sat up bare-chested in bed in the dark and, feeling like a crook in a French movie, lit a cigarette and stared out at Lexington Avenue, which was practically empty at that hour. Cabs just coming on duty, just going off, who knew which. But the dream, which had seemed prophetic, refused to dissipate and hung like a poisonous vapor, my heart still pounding from the airy danger of it, its sense of openness and hazard. Deserves to be shot. I'd worried enough about the painting when I believed it to be safely maintained year-round, as I'd been assured by the storage brochure, in brisk professional tones, at a conservatorially acceptable 70 degrees Fahrenheit and 50% humidity. You couldn't keep something like that just anywhere. It couldn't take cold or heat or moisture or direct sun. It required a calibrated environment, like the orchids in the flower shop. To imagine it shoved behind a pizza oven was enough to make my idolater's heart pound with a different but similar version of the terror I'd felt when I thought the driver was going to chuck poor Popper off the bus, in the rain, in the middle of nowhere, out by the side of the road. After all, just how long had Boris had the picture? Boris, even Horst, avowed art lover, hadn't, with that apartment of his, struck me as overly particular about conservatorial issues. Disastrous possibilities abounded. Rembrandt's storm on the Sea of Galilee, the only seascape he'd ever painted, according to rumor all but ruined from being stored improperly. Vermeer's masterpiece, The Love Letter, cut off its stretchers by a hotel waiter, flaking and creased from being sandwiched under a mattress. Picasso's Poverty and Gauguin's Tahitian Landscape, water damaged after being hidden by some numbskull in a public toilet. In my obsessive reading, the story that haunted me most was Caravaggio's Nativity with St. Francis and St. Lawrence, stolen from the oratory of San Lorenzo and slashed from the frame so carelessly that the collector who'd commissioned the theft had burst out crying when he saw it and refused to take it. Kitsy's phone, I'd noticed, was missing from its usual place, the charger dock on the windowsill where she always grabbed for it first thing in the morning. Sometimes I woke in the middle of the night to see the backlight glowing blue in the dark on her side of the bed, under the covers, from her secret nest of sheets.
"Oh, just checking the time," she said,
if I tumbled over drowsily to ask what she was doing. I imagined it switched off and buried deep in the crocodile bag with Kitsy's usual mess of lip gloss and business cards and perfume samples and cash floating loose, crumpled 20s falling out every time she reached for her hairbrush. There, in that fragrant jumble, Cable would be calling repeatedly in the night, leaving multiple texts and voicemails for her to find when she woke in the morning. What did they talk about? What did they say to each other? Oddly enough, it was easy to imagine their interaction. Bright chatter, a sense of sly connivance, Cable calling her silly names in bed, and tickling her until she shrieked. Grinding out my cigarette. No form, no sense, no meaning. Kitsy disliked it when I smoked in her bedroom, but when she found the cigarette butt smashed out in the Limoges box on her dresser, I doubted she was going to have anything to say about it. To understand the world at all, sometimes you could only focus on a tiny bit of it, look very hard at what was close to hand, and make it stand in for the whole. But ever since the painting had vanished from under me, I'd felt drowned and extinguished by vastness.
not just the predictable vastness of time and space, but the impassable distances between people, even when they were within arm's reach of each other. And with a swell of vertigo, I thought of all the places I'd been and all the places I hadn't. A world lost and vast and unknowable. Dingy maze of cities and alleyways. Far drifting ash and hostile distances. Connections missed. Things lost and never found. And my painting, swept away on that powerful current and drifting out there somewhere. A tiny fragment of spirit. Faint spark. Bobbing on a dark sea.
24. Since I couldn't get back to sleep, I left without waking Kitsy in the icy black hour before sunup, shivering as I dressed in the dark. One of the roommates had come in and was running a shower, and the last thing I wanted was to bump into either of them on the way out. By the time I got off the F train, the sky was turning pale, dragging home in the bitter cold, depressed, dead tired, letting myself in at the side door, trudging up to my room, smudged up glasses, reeking of smoke and sex and curry and Kitsy's Chanel number 19, stopping to greet Popchik, who had bundled down the hall and was looping the loop with unusual excitement at my feet, pulling my rolled necktie out of my pocket so I could hang it on the rack on the back of the door. My blood almost froze when I heard a voice from the kitchen.
Theo? Is that you?
Red head poking around the corner. It was her, coffee cup in hand.
Sorry, did I scare you? I didn't mean to.
I stood transfixed, dumbfounded, as she put out her arms to me with sort of a happy crooning noise, Popchik whining and capering in excitement at our feet. She was still wearing the things she'd slept in. Candy-striped pajama bottoms and a long-sleeved t-shirt with an old sweater of Hobie's over it, and she still smelled like tossed bedsheets and bed. Oh, God, I thought, closing my eyes and pressing my face into her shoulder, with a rush of happiness and fear, swift draft from heaven. Oh, God.
Lovely to see you.
There she was, her hair, her eyes, her... bitten down nails like Boris's and a pout to the lower lip like a child who'd sucked her thumb too much. Red, tousled head like a dahlia.
How are you? I've missed you.
All my resolutions gone in a second.
What are you doing here? I was flying to Montreal.
Harsh laugh of a much younger girl. A hoarse playground laugh.
Stopping over to see my friend Sam for a few days. And then going to meet Everett in California.
Sam, I thought.
Anyway, my plane got rerouted.
She took a gulp of her coffee, wordlessly offered the cup to me.
Want some? No.
Another gulp.
And I was stuck at Newark. And I thought, why not? I'll take the rain check and come into the city and see you guys. Huh. That's great.
You guys. I was included in that, too.
Thought it might be fun to pop in, since I won't be here for Christmas. Also, since your party's tomorrow. Married! Congratulations!
She had her fingertips on my arm, and when she stretched up on tiptoe to kiss me on the cheek, I felt her kiss go all through me.
When do I get to meet her? Hobie says she's a dreamboat. Are you excited?
I was so stunned I put my hand to the place where her lips had been, where I still felt the press of them glowing. And then when I realized how it must look, took it rapidly away.
Yes, thanks. It's good to see you. You're looking well.
She didn't appear to notice how dumbstruck, how dizzy, how completely gobsmacked I was at the sight of her. Or maybe she did notice and didn't want to hurt my feelings.
Where's Hobie?
I said. I wasn't asking because I cared, but because it was a little too good to be true to be alone in the house with her. And a little frightening, too.
Oh,
she rolled her eyes.
He insisted on going to the bakery. I told him not to bother, but you know how he is. He likes to get me those blueberry biscuits that Mama and Welty used to buy me when I was little. Can't believe they even make them anymore. They don't have them every day, he says. Sure you don't want some coffee?
Moving to the stove, just the trace of a limp in her walk. It was extraordinary. I could hardly hear a word she was saying. It was always like this when I was in the room with her. She overrode everything. Her skin, her eyes, her rusty voice, flame-colored hair, and a tilt to her head that sometimes gave her a look like she was humming to herself. And the light in the kitchen was all mixed up with the light of her presence, with color and freshness and beauty.
I have some CDs I've burned for you.
Turning to look at me over her shoulder.
Wish I'd thought to bring them. Didn't know I'd be stopping, though. I'll be sure and pop them in the mail when I get back home.
And I have some CDs for you. There was a whole stack of them in my room. Things I'd bought because they reminded me of her. So many I'd felt funny sending them. And books. And jewelry, I neglected to say. And scarves, and posters, and perfume, and records on vinyl, and a make-your-own-kite kit, and a toy pagoda, an 18th-century topaz necklace, a first edition of Ozma of Oz. Buying the things had been mostly a way of thinking of her, of being with her. Some of it I'd given to Kitsy, but still there was no way I could come out of my room with the gigantic pile of stuff I'd actually bought for her over the years, because it would look completely insane.
Books? Oh, that's great. I finished my book on the plane. I need something else. We can swap.
Sure. Bare feet, blush pink ears, the pearl white skin at the scoop neck of her t-shirt.
Rings of Saturn. Everett said he thought you might like it. He says hi, by the way.
Oh, right. Hi. I hated this pretense of hers, that Everett and I were friends.
What?
Actually, my hands were shaking, and I wasn't even hungover. I could only hope she didn't see. Actually, I'm just going to duck in my room for a second, all right? She looked startled, touched her fingertips to her forehead. Silly me.
Oh, right. Sorry. I'll just be in here.
I didn't start to breathe again until I was in my room with the door shut. My suit was okay, for yesterday's, but my hair was dirty and I needed a shower. Should I shave? Change my shirt? Or would she notice? Would it look weird that I'd run in and tried to clean up for her? Could I get in the bathroom and brush my teeth without her noticing? But then suddenly I had a rush of counter-panic that I was sitting in my room with the door closed, wasting valuable moments with her. I got up again and opened the door. Hey, I yelled down the hall. Her head appeared again.
Hey.
Want to go to the movies with me tonight? Slight beat of surprise.
Well, sure. What?
Documentary about Glenn Gould. Been dying to see it. In fact, I'd already seen it, and had been sitting in the theater the whole time pretending she was with me, imagining her reaction at various parts, imagining the amazing conversation we would have about it after.
Sounds fantastic. What time?
7-ish. I'll check. 25. All day, I was practically out of body at the thought of the evening ahead. Downstairs in the store, where I was too busy with Christmas customers to devote undivided attention to my plans, I thought about what I would wear. Something casual, not a suit, nothing too studied. And where I would take her to dinner, nothing too fancy, nothing that would put her on guard or seem self-conscious on my part, but really special all the same. Special and charming, and quiet enough for us to talk and not too terribly far from Film Forum. Besides which, she'd been out of the city for a while. She'd probably enjoy going someplace new.
Oh, this little place?
Yeah, it's great. Glad you like it. A real find. But apart from all the above, and quiet was the main thing, more than food or location, I didn't want to be any place where we were going to have to yell. It was going to have to be someplace I could get us in at short notice. And then, too, there was the vegetarian issue. Someplace adorable. Not too expensive to raise alarms. It couldn't look as if I was going to too much trouble. It had to seem thoughtless, unplanned. How the hell could she be living with this goofball Everett? With his bad clothes and his rabbit teeth and his always startled eyes. Who looked as if his idea of a hot time was brown rice and seaweed from the counter at the back of the health food store. And so the day crawled, and then it was 6, and Hobie was home from his day out with Pippa, and he was poking his head in the store.
So, he said after a pause, in a cheerful but cautious tone that reminded me
ominously of the tone my mother had taken with my dad when she came home and found him buzzing about on the verge of an upswing. Hobie knew how I felt about Pippa. I'd never told him, never breathed a word of it, but he knew. And even if he hadn't, it would have been perfectly visible to him, or any stranger walking in off the street, that I practically had sparks flying out of my head.
How's everything?
Great. How was your day?
Oh, wonderful.
With relief.
I was able to get us in at Union Square for lunch. We sat at the bar. Wish you'd been with us. Then we went up to Moira's, and the three of us walked over to the Asia Society, and now she's out doing a bit of Christmas shopping. She says you're meeting her later tonight?
Casual, but with the unease of a parent wondering if an erratic teenager is really going to be okay taking the car out.
Film forum?
Right, I said nervously. I didn't want him to know I was taking her to the Glenn Gould movie since he knew I'd already seen it.
She said you two are going to the Glenn Gould?
Well, I was dying to go again.
Don't tell her I've been, I said impulsively,
and then, did you?
No,
hastily drawing himself up.
I didn't.
Well, Hobie rubbed his nose.
Well, listen, I'm sure it's great. I'm dying to see it as well. Not tonight, though, he added quickly. Some other time.
Oh, trying hard to sound bummed out, doing a bad job of it.
In any case, want me to mind the shop for you? In case you want to go upstairs for a wash and a brush-up? You should be leaving here no later than 6:30 if you plan on walking over there, you know.
26. On the way over, I couldn't help humming and smiling, and when I turned the corner and spotted her standing out in front of the theater, I was so nervous I had to stop and compose myself for a moment before rushing in to greet her, helping her with her bags. She, laden with shopping, babbling about her day. Perfect, perfect bliss of standing in line with her, huddling close because it was cold, and then inside, the red carpet, and the whole evening ahead of us, clapping her gloved hands together.
Oh, do you want some popcorn?
Sure.
Me springing to the counter. Popcorn's great here. And then, walking into the theater together, me touching her back casually, the velvety back of her coat, perfect brown coat, and perfect green hat, and perfect, perfect little red head.
Here? Aisle? Do you like the aisle?
We'd gone to the movies just enough, 5 times, for me to make careful note of where she liked to sit. Plus, I knew it well enough from Hobie after years of inconspicuously questioning him as much as I dared about her tastes, her likes and dislikes, her habits, slipping the questions in casually, one at a time over a matter of years. Does she like this? Does she like that? And there she was, turning and smiling at me. At me. And there were way too many people in the theater because it was the 7 o'clock show. Way more people than I was comfortable with, given my generalized anxiety and hatred of crowded places. And more people trickling in even after the film had already started. But I didn't care. It could have been a foxhole in the Somme, being shelled by the Germans, and all that mattered was her next to me in the dark, her arm beside mine. And the music. Glenn Gould at the piano. Wild-haired. Ebullient, head thrown back, emissary from the realm of angels, wrapped and consumed by the sublime. I kept stealing looks at her, unable to help myself, but it was at least 30 minutes in before I had the nerve to turn and look at her full on, profile washed white in the glow from the screen, and realized, to my horror, that she wasn't enjoying the film. She was bored. No. She was upset. I spent the rest of the film miserable, hardly seeing it. Or, rather, I was seeing it, but in a wholly different way. Not the ecstatic prodigy, not the mystic, the solitary, heroically quitting the concert stage at the height of his fame to retreat into the snows of Canada, but the hypochondriac, the recluse, the isolate, the paranoiac, the pill popper. No, the drug addict, the obsessive, glove-wearing, germ-phobic, bundled year-round with scarves, twitching and racked with compulsions. The hunched, nocturnal weirdo, so unsure how to conduct even the most basic relations with people that, in an interview which I was suddenly finding tortuous, he had asked a recording engineer if they couldn't go to a lawyer and legally be declared brothers. Sort of the tragic, late genius version of Tom Cable and I pressing cut thumbs in the darkened backyard of his house, or, even more strangely, Boris seizing my hand, bloody at the knuckles, where I'd punched him on the playground, and pressing it to his own bloodied mouth. 27. That upset you, I said impulsively when we were leaving the theater. I'm sorry. She glanced up at me as if shocked I'd noticed. We'd come out into a bluish, dream-lit world. The first snow of the season, 5 inches on the ground. We could have left if you wanted. In answer, she only shook her head in a sort of stunned way. Snow whirling down, magical, like a pure idea of North, the pure North of the movie.
Well, no, she said reluctantly. I mean, it's not that I didn't enjoy it.
Floundering up the street. Neither of us had the proper shoes. The crunch of our feet was loud, and I listened attentively, waiting for her to continue, and ready to grasp her elbow in a minute if she slipped. But when she turned to look at me, all she said was,
Oh, God, we're never going to get a cab, are we?
Mind racing. What about dinner? What to do? Did she want to go home? Fuck! It's not that far.
Oh, I know, but... Oh, there's one,
she cried, and my heart plunged until I saw, thankfully, that someone else had grabbed it. Hey, I said. We were near Bedford Street. Lights, cafes. What do you say we try up here?
For a cab?
No. For something to eat. Was she hungry? Please, God, let her be hungry. Or a drink, at least. 28. Somehow, as if by prearrangement of the gods, the half-empty wine bar we'd ducked into, on impulse, was warm and golden and candlelit, and much, much better than any of the restaurants I'd planned for. Tiny table, my knee to her knee. Was she aware of it? Quite as aware as I was? Bloom of the candle flame on her face, flame glinting metallic in her hair. Hair so bright it looked about to catch fire. Everything blazing. Everything sweet. They were playing old Bob Dylan, more than perfect for narrow village streets close to Christmas, and the snow whirling down in big feathery flakes. The kind of winter where you want to be walking down a city street with your arm around a girl, like on the old record cover. Because Pippa was exactly that girl. Not the prettiest, but the no makeup and kind of ordinary-looking girl he'd chosen to be happy with. And in fact, that picture was an ideal of happiness in its way. The hike of his shoulders and the slightly embarrassed quality of her smile. That open-ended look, like they might just wander off anywhere they wanted together. And there she was. Her. And she was talking about herself. Affectionate and old shoe. Asking me about Hobie and the shop and my spirits. And what I was reading and what I was listening to. Lots and lots of questions, but seeming anxious to share her life with me, too. Her chilly flat expensive to heat, depressing light, and damp, stale smell. Cheap clothes on the high street, and so many American chains in London now it's like a shopping mall. And what meds are you on, and what meds am I on? We both had post-traumatic stress disorder, a malady that in England had different initials, it seemed. And got you sent to a hospital for army vets if you weren't careful. Her tiny garden, which she shared with half a dozen people, and the batty Englishwoman who'd filled it with ailing tortoises she'd smuggled from the south of France.
They all die of cold and malnutrition. It's really cruel. She doesn't feed them properly. Crumbled bread, can you imagine? I buy them turtle food at the pet store without telling her.
And how terribly she wanted a dog. But of course it was hard in London with the quarantine, which they had in Switzerland too. How did she always end up living in all these dog-unfriendly places? And wow, I looked better than she'd seen me in years. She'd missed me. Missed the hell out of me. What an amazing evening. And we'd been there for hours, laughing over little things, but being serious too. Very grave.
She being both generous and receptive. This was another thing about her. She listened. Her attention was dazzling. I never had the feeling that other people listened to me half as closely. I felt like a different person in her company, a better one. Could say things to her I couldn't say to anyone else, certainly not Kitsy, who had a brittle way of deflating serious comments by making a joke, or switching to another topic, or interrupting, or sometimes just pretending not to hear. And it was an utter delight to be with her. I loved her every minute of every day, heart and mind and soul and all of it. And it was getting late, and I wanted the place never to close. Never.
No, no,
she was saying, running a finger around the rim of her wine glass. The shape of her hands moved me intensely, Welty's signet on her forefinger. I could stare at her hands the way I could never stare at her face without seeming like a creep.
I loved the movie, actually. And the music.
She laughed, and the laugh, for me, had all the joy of the music behind it.
Knocked the breath out of me. Welty saw him play once at Carnegie. One of the great nights of his life, he said. It's just...
Yes? The smell of her wine. Red wine stain on her mouth. This was one of the great nights of my life.
Well...
She shook her head.
The concert scenes. The look of those rehearsal halls. Because, you know...
Rubbing her arms.
It was really, really hard. Practice, 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 6 hours a day. My arms would ache from holding the flute up. And well, I'm sure you've heard plenty of it too. That positive thinking crap that it's so easy for teachers and physical therapists to dole out. Oh, you can do it. We believe in you. And falling for it. And working hard and working harder. And hating yourself because you're not working hard enough. Thinking it's your fault you're not doing better. And working even harder, and then, well...
I was silent. I knew all about this from Hobie, who had spoken of it in great distress, and at some length. It seemed that Aunt Margaret had been perfectly correct to send her to the wacko Swiss school with all the doctors and the therapy. Though to all normal standards she'd recovered from the accident completely, still there was a bit of neural damage, just enough to matter on the high end. Slight impairment of fine motor skills. It was subtle, but it was there. For almost any other vocation or avocation, singer, potter, zookeeper, any doctor apart from a surgeon, it wouldn't have mattered. But for her, it did.
And I don't know. I listen to a lot of music at home, fall asleep with the iPod every night. But when's the last time I went to a concert?
She said sadly. Falling asleep with the iPod? Did that mean that she and what's-his-name weren't having sex? And why don't you go to concerts? I said, filing away this bit of info for later. Audiences bother you? Crowds?
Knew you'd understand.
Well, I'm sure that this has been suggested to you, because it's certainly been suggested to me.
What?
What was the charm of that sad smile? How could you break it down?
Xanax? Beta blockers? Hypnosis?
All of the above.
Well, if it was a panic attack, maybe. But it's not. Remorse, grief, jealousy. That's the worst of all. I mean, this girl Beta, that's a stupid name, isn't it, Beta? Really mediocre player. I don't mean to be snotty, but she could hardly keep up with the section when we were kids. And she's in the Cleveland Philharmonic now, and it upsets me more than I would admit to just anyone. But they don't have a drug for any of that, do they?
Actually they did. And Jerome, up on Adam Clayton Powell, was doing a booming business in it.
The acoustics. The audiences. It triggers something. I go home, I hate everyone. I talk to myself. Have arguments with myself in different voices. I'm upset for days. And, well, I told you, teaching, I tried it. It wasn't for me.
Pippa didn't have to work, thanks to Aunt Margaret and Uncle Welty's money. Everett didn't work either, thanks to same. The music librarian thing I'd gathered, though presented originally as a striking career choice, was really more on the lines of an unpaid internship, with Pippa footing the bill.
Teenagers. Well, I won't even go into the torture of that, watching them
head off to conservatory or to Mexico City for the summer to play in the symphony. And the younger kids aren't serious enough. I'm annoyed with them for being kids. To me, it's like they're taking it too lightly, throwing what they have away.
Well, teaching's a shit job. I wouldn't want to do it either.
Yes, but...
Gulp of wine.
If I can't play, what else is there? Because, I mean, I'm around music, sort of, with Everett. And I keep going to school and keep taking courses. But quite honestly, I don't like London that much. It's dark and rainy, and I don't have a whole lot of friends there. And in my flat sometimes I can hear someone crying at night. Just this terrible broken weeping from next door. And I mean, you found something you like to do, and I'm so glad, because sometimes I really wonder what I'm doing with my life.
Desperately, I tried to think of just the right thing to say. Come home.
Home? You mean here?
Of course.
What about Everett?
I had nothing to say to this. She looked at me critically.
You really don't like him, do you?
What was the point of lying? No.
Well, if you knew him better, you would. He's a good guy. Very serene and even-tempered. Very stable.
I had nothing to say to this, either. I was none of these things.
Also, London, I mean, I've thought about coming back to New York.
You have?
Of course. I miss Hobie. A lot.
He jokes how he could rent me an apartment here for what we spend on the phone. Of course, he's living back in the days when long distance to London cost $5 a minute or whatever.
Pretty much every time we speak, he tries to talk me into coming back. Well, you know Hobie. He never says it outright. But, you know, constant hints, always tells me about jobs opening up, positions at Columbia and stuff.
He does?
Well, on some level, I can't fathom that I live so far away. Welty was the one who took me to music lessons and to the symphony. But Hobie was the one always home, you know, who went upstairs and made me a snack after school and helped me plant marigolds for my science project. Even now, when I have a bad cold, when I can't remember how to cook artichokes or get candle wax off the tablecloth, who do I call? Him. But
was it my imagination? Was the wine getting her worked up a little bit?
Tell you the truth. Know why I don't come back more? In London.
Was she about to cry?
I wouldn't tell everybody this, but in London at least I don't think every second about it. This is the way I walked home the day before. This is where Welty and Hobie and I had dinner the next to last time. At least there I don't think quite so much, should I turn left here? Should I turn right? My whole destiny hanging on whether I take the F train or the 6. Awful premonitions. Everything petrified. When I come back here, I'm 13 again. And I mean, not in a good way. Everything stopped that day. Literally. I even stopped growing. Because did you know? I never got 1 inch taller after it happened. Not one.
You're a perfect size.
Well, it's fairly common,
she said, ignoring my clumsy compliment.
Injured and traumatized children. They quite often fail to grow to normal height.
She went in and out, unconsciously, of her Dr. Kamenzind voice. Even though I'd never met Dr. Kamenzind, I could sense the moments when Dr. Kamenzind took over, a kind of cool distancing mechanism.
Resources are diverted. The growth system shuts down. There was one girl at my school, Saudi princess, who was kidnapped when she was 12. The guys who did it were executed. But I met her when she was 19. Nice girl, but tiny, like only 4'11 or something. She was so traumatized that she never grew an inch past the day they snatched her.
Wow, that underground cell girl? She was at school with you?
Mont Heffeli was weird. You had girls who'd been shot at while fleeing the presidential palace. And then you had girls who got sent there because their parents wanted them to lose weight or train for the Winter Olympics.
She accepted my hand in hers, without saying anything. All bundled up, she hadn't let them take her coat. Long sleeves in summer, always swathed in half a dozen scarves, like some sort of cocooned insect wrapped in layers.
protective padding for a girl who'd been broken and stitched and bolted back together again. How could I have been so blind? No wonder the film had upset her. Glenn Gould huddled year-round in heavy overcoats, pill bottles piling up, concert stage abandoned, snow growing deeper round him by the year.
Because, I mean, I've never heard you talk about it. I know you're as obsessed as I am, but I go over and over it, too.
The waitress had inconspicuously poured her more wine, refilled it to the top without Pippa even asking or seeming to notice. Dear waitress, I thought, God bless you, I'm leaving you a tip to knock your socks off.
If only I'd signed up to audition on Tuesday or Thursday. If only I'd let Welty take me to the museum when he wanted. He'd been trying to get me up to that show for weeks. He was determined that I see it before it came down. But I always had something better to do. More important to go to the movies with my friend Leanne, whatever, who incidentally vanished into thin air after my accident. Never saw her again after that afternoon at the stupid Pixar film. All these tiny signs that I ignored, or didn't fully recognize. Everything could have been different if only I'd been paying attention. Like, Welty was trying so hard to get me to go earlier, he must have asked a dozen times. It was like he had a sense of it himself. Something bad going to happen. It was my fault we were even there that day.
At least you hadn't been expelled from school.
Were you expelled?
Suspended. Bad enough.
It's weird to think if it had never happened. If we hadn't both been there that day, we might not know each other. What do you think we would be doing now?
I don't know, I said, a bit startled. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, but you must have an idea.
I wasn't like you. I didn't have a talent.
What'd you do for fun?
Nothing that interesting. The usual, computer games, sci-fi stuff. When people asked me what I wanted to be, I'd usually be a smartass and say, I wanted to be a Blade Runner or something like that.
God, I'm so haunted by that movie. I think about Tyrell's niece a lot.
What do you mean?
That scene where she's looking at the pictures on the piano, when she's trying to figure out whether her memories belong to her or Tyrell's niece. I go back through the past, too, only looking for signs, you know? Things I should have picked up on, but missed.
Listen, you're right. I think like that too, but omens, signs, partial knowledge. There's no logical way you could... Why couldn't I ever get a sentence to come out right around her? Can I just say how cuckoo it sounds? Especially when someone else says it? To blame yourself for not predicting the future?
Well, maybe. But Dr. Kamenzine says we all do it. Accidents, catastrophes, something like 75% of disaster victims are convinced there were warning signs they brushed off or didn't pick up on correctly, and with children under 18, the percentage is even higher. But that doesn't mean the signs weren't there, does it?
I don't think it's like that. In hindsight, sure. But I think maybe it's more like a column of figures where you add two numbers wrong at the start, and it throws the total. If you trace it back, you can see the mistake,
the point where you would have had a different outcome. Yes, but that's almost as bad, isn't it? To see the mistake? The place where you went wrong and not be able to go back and fix it? My audition,
large gulp of wine,
pre-college orchestra at Juilliard. My solfège teacher had told me I might get second chair, but if I played really well, I might have a shot at first. And I guess it was a big deal, sort of. But, Welty.
Yes, definitely tears, eyes shining in the firelight.
I knew I was wrong nagging him to come uptown with me. There was no reason for him to come. Welty spoiled me rotten even when my mother was alive. But after she died, he spoiled me more. And it was a big day for me, sure. But was it as important as I made it seem? No. Because...
She was crying now, a little.
I didn't even want to go to the museum. I wanted him to come uptown with me because I knew he'd take me out to lunch before the audition, anywhere I wanted. He should have stayed home that day. He had other stuff to do. They didn't even let family sit in. He would have had to wait down the hall.
He knew what he was doing. She glanced up at me as if I'd said exactly the wrong thing. Only I knew it was the right thing, if only I could voice it correctly. The whole time we were together, he was talking about you. And what?
Nothing.
I closed my eyes, overwhelmed with the wine, with her, with the impossibility of explaining it. It's just his last moments on Earth, you know? And the space between my life and his was very, very thin. There wasn't any space. It was like something opened up between us, like a huge flash of what was real, what mattered. No me, no him. We were the same person. Same thoughts. We didn't have to talk. It was just a few minutes, but it might have been years. We might as well still be there. And, I know this sounds weird. In fact, it was a completely lunatic analogy. Crackpot, insane. But I didn't know any other way to work around to what I wanted to say. But, you know Barbara Gibbery, who does those seminars up in Rhinebeck? Those past life regression things? Reincarnation and karmic ties and all that? Souls who have been together for a lot of lifetimes? I know, I said at her startled and slightly alarmed look. Every time I see Barbara, she tells me I need to chant or rum or whatever to heal, like the blocked chakras, deficient muladhara. I'm not kidding you, that was her diagnosis of me. Unrooted, constriction of the heart, fragmented energy field. I was just standing there having a cocktail and minding my own business, and here she comes drifting up telling me all these foods I need to eat to ground myself. I was losing her, I could see it. Sorry, I'm wandering off topic a little. It's just, well, we've had this discussion. All that stuff irritates the hell out of me. Hobie was standing there too, drinking a big old scotch, and he said, "What about me, Barbara? Should I eat some root vegetables? Stand on my head?" And she just patted him on the arm and said, "Oh, no worries, James. You are an advanced being." That got a laugh out of her. But Welty, he was one too. An advanced being. Like, not joking, serious, out of the ballpark. Those stories that Barbara tells, Guru What's-His-Name putting his hand on her head in Burma, and in that 1 minute she was infused with knowledge and became a different person.
Well, I mean, Everett, of course, he never met Krishnamurti, but...
Right. Everett, why this annoyed me quite so much, I didn't know. Had attended some sort of guru-based boarding school in the south of England, where the classes had names like Care for the Earth and Thinking of Others. But, I mean, it's like Welty's energy, or force field. God, that sounds so corny, but I don't know what else you'd call it. It's been with me from that hour on. I was there for him, and he was there for me. It's sort of permanent. I had never quite vocalized this before, to anyone, although it was something I felt very deeply. Like, I think about him. He's present. His personality is with me. I mean, pretty much the second I came to stay with Hobie, I was up there in the shop. It reeled me in. Just this instinctive thing, I can't explain it, because was I interested in antiques? No. Why would I be? And yet there I was, going through his inventory, reading his notes in the margins of auction catalogs. His world, his things, everything up there, it drew me like a flame. Not that I was even looking for it, more that it was looking for me. And I mean, before I was 18, no one taught me. It was like I knew already. I was up there on my own and doing Welty's job. Like, I crossed my legs restlessly. Did you ever think how weird that he sent me to your house? Chance, maybe. But it didn't seem like chance to me. It was like he saw who I was, and he was sending me exactly where I needed to be, to who I needed to be with. So, yeah, coming to myself a bit, I was talking a little too fast. Yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to go off.
That's okay.
Silence. Her eyes on mine. But unlike Kitsy, who was always at least partly somewhere else, who loathed serious talk, who at a similar turn would be looking around for the waitress, or making whatever light and or comic remark she could think of to keep the moment from getting too intense. She was listening. She was right with me. And I could see only too well how saddened she was at my condition. A sadness only worsened by the fact she truly liked me. We had a lot in common, a mental connection and an emotional one too. She enjoyed my company. She trusted me. She wished me well. She wanted above all to be my friend. And whereas some women might have preened themselves and taken pleasure at my misery, it was not amusing to her to see how torn up I was over her. 29. The next day, which was the day of the engagement party, all the closeness of the previous evening was gone, and all that remained, at breakfast, in our quick hellos in the hallway, was the frustration of knowing I would not have her to myself again. We were awkward with each other, bumping into each other coming and going, talking a little too loudly and cheerfully, and I was reminded, all too sadly, of her visit the previous summer, 4 months before she'd shown up with Everett, and the rich, passionate talk we'd had out on the stoop, just the two of us, as it was getting dark, huddled side by side, like a pair of old tramps, my knee to her knee, my arm touching hers, and the two of us looking out at the people on the street and talking about all sorts of things, childhood, playdates in Central Park, and skating at Woolman Rink. Had we ever seen each other in the old days? Brushed past each other on the ice? About the Misfits, which we'd just watched on TV with Hobie. About Marilyn Monroe, whom we both loved. A little springtime ghost. And about poor ruined Montgomery Clift, walking around with handfuls of loose pills in his pockets. A detail I hadn't known and didn't comment upon. And about the death of Clark Gable, and how horribly guilty Marilyn had felt for it, how responsible, which somehow, oddly, spiraled into talk of fate, and the occult, and fortune-telling. Did birthdays have anything to do with luck, or lack of it? Bad transits, stars in unfortunate alignment. What would a palm reader say? Have you ever had your palm read? No, you? Maybe we should walk over to the psychic healer storefront on 6th Avenue with the purple lights and the crystal balls. It looks like it's open 24 hours a day. Oh, right. You mean the lava lamp place where the crazy Romanian woman stands in the door belching, talking until it was so dark we could hardly see each other, whispering though there was no reason to. Do you want to go in? No, not yet. And the fat summer moon shining white and pure overhead. And my love for her was really just that pure, as simple and steady as the moon. But then finally we had to go inside, and almost the instant we did, the spell was broken. And in the brightness of the hallway, we were embarrassed and stiff with each other, almost as if the house lights had been turned up at the end of a play, and all our closeness exposed for what it was. Make-believe. For months, I had been desperate to recapture that moment. And, in the bar, for an hour or two. I had. But it was all unreal again. We were back right where we started, and I tried to tell myself it was enough. Just to have had her all to myself for a few hours. Only it wasn't. 30. Anne DeLarmison, Kitsy's godmother, was hosting our party at a private club which even Hobie had never set foot in, but knew all about. Its history, venerable. Its architects, illustrious. And its membership, stellar, running the gamut from Aaron Burr to the Whartons.
Supposed to be one of the best early Greek revival interiors in New York State, he'd informed us with earnest delight. The staircases, the mantels. I wonder if we'll be allowed in the reading room. The plasterwork's original, I'm told. Really something to see.
How many people will be there? Pippa asked. She'd been forced to walk down to Morgan Le Fay and buy a dress since she hadn't packed for the party.
Couple hundred?
Of that number, maybe 15 of the guests, including Pippa and Hobie, Mr. Bracegirdle and Mrs. DeFreeze, were mine. 100 were Kitsy's, and the remainder were people whom even Kitsy claimed not to know.
Including, said Hobie, the mayor, and both senators, and Prince Albert of Monaco, isn't that right? They invited Prince Albert. I seriously doubt he's coming. Oh, just an intimate thing, then, for the family.
Look, I'm just showing up and doing what they tell me. It was Anne de Larmeson who had seized high command of the wedding in the crisis, her word, of Mrs. Barber's indifference. It was Anne de Larmeson who was negotiating for the right church, the right minister. It was Anne de Larmeson who would work out the guest lists, dazzling, and the seating charts, unbelievably tricky, and who, in the end, it seemed, would have final say about everything from the ring-bearer's cushion to the cake. It was Anne de Larmeson who had managed to get hold of just the designer for the dress, and who'd offered her a estate in St. Bart's for the honeymoon, whom Kitsy phoned whenever a question arose, which it did, multiple times per day, and who, in Tottie's phrase, had firmly installed herself as wedding Obergruppenführer. What made this all so comical and perverse was that Anne de Larmeson was so disturbed by me she could hardly stand to look at me. I was worlds from the match she had hoped for her goddaughter. Even my name was too vulgar to be spoken.
And what does the groom think? Will the groom be providing me with his guest list any time soon?
Clearly a marriage to someone like me, a furniture dealer, was a fate akin, more or less, to death. Hence the pomp and spectacle of the arrangements, the grim sense of ceremony, as if Kitsy were some lost princess of Ur, to be feasted and decked in finery, and, attended by tambourine players and handmaidens, paraded down in splendor to the underworld.
31.
Since I didn't see any particular reason I needed my wits about me for the party, I made sure to get good and looped before I left, with an emergency OC tucked into the pocket of my best Turnbull and Asser, just in case. The club was so beautiful that I resented the press of guests, which made it difficult to see the architectural details, the portraits hung frame to frame, some of them very fine, and the rare books on the shelves. Red velvet swags, garlands of Christmas balsam. Were those real candles on the tree? I stood in a daze at the top of the stairs, not wanting to greet or talk to people, not wanting to be there at all. Hand on my sleeve.
What's the matter?
Said Pippa. What? I couldn't meet her eye.
You look so sad.
I am, I said, but I wasn't sure if she heard or not. I almost didn't hear myself saying it, because at exactly the same moment, Hobie, sensing we'd fallen behind, had doubled back to find us in the crowd, shouting,
Ah, there you are.
Go, attend to your guests, he said, giving me a friendly parental nudge. Everyone's asking for you.
Among the strangers, he and Pippa were two of the only really unique or interesting-looking people there. She, like a fairy in her gauzy-sleeved, diaphanous green, he elegant and endearing in his midnight blue double-breasted, his beautiful old shoes from Peel and Company. Hopelessly I looked around.
Don't worry about us. We'll catch up later.
Right, I said, steeling myself. But, leaving them to study a portrait of John Adams near the coat check, where they were waiting for Mrs. DeFreeze to drop off her mink, and making my way through the crowded rooms, there was no one I recognized except Mrs. Barber, whom I really didn't feel I could face, only she saw me before I could get by and caught me by the sleeve. She was backed in a doorway with her gin and lime, being addressed by a saturnine, sprightly old gentleman with a hard red face and a hard, clear voice and two gray puffs of hair on either side of his ears.
Oh, Medora, he was saying, rocking back on his heels. Still a constant delight. Darling old girl. Rare and impressive. Nearly 90. Her family, of course, of the purest Knickerbocker strain, as she always likes to remind one. Oh, you should see her, full of ginger with the attendant.
Here he permitted himself an indulgent little chuckle.
This is dreadful, my dear, but so amusing. At least I think you will find it so.
They cannot now hire attendants of color. That's the term now, isn't it? Of color? Because Medora has such a proclivity for, shall we say, the patois of her youth. Particularly when they are trying to restrain her or get her into the bathtub. Quite a fighter when the mood takes her, I hear. Got after one of the African-American orderlies with a fireplace poker. Well, you know, there but for the grace of God. She was of what I suppose might be called the cabin-in-the-sky generation, Medora. And the father did have the family place in Virginia. Goochland County, was it? Mercenary marriage, if ever I saw one. Still, the son. You've met the son, haven't you? Was rather a disappointment, wasn't he? With the drink. And the daughter. Bit of a social failure. Well, that's putting it delicately. Quite overweight. Collects the cats, if you know what I mean. Now, Medora's brother, Owen. Owen was a dear, dear man. Died of a heart attack in the locker room of the athletic club. Having a bit of an intimate moment in the locker room of the athletic club, if you understand me. Lovely man, Owen, but he was always a bit of a lost soul. Ceased to live without really finding himself, I feel.
Theo, said Mrs. Barber,
putting her hand out to me quite suddenly as I was trying to edge away, as a person trapped in a burning car might make a last-minute clutch at rescue personnel.
Theo, I'd like for you to meet Havistock Irving.
Havistock Irving turned to me with a keen and, to me, not wholly congenial beam of interest.
Theodore Decker.
Afraid so, I said, taken aback.
I see.
I liked his look less and less.
You are surprised I know you. Well, you see, I know your esteemed partner, Mr. Hobart, and his esteemed partner, Mr. Blackwell, before you.
Is that so? I said, with resolute blandness. In the antiques trade, I had daily occasion to deal with insinuating old gents of his stripe, and Mrs. Barber, who had not let go of my hand, only squeezed it tighter.
Direct descendant of Washington Irving, Havistock is, she said helpfully. Writing a biography of.
How interesting.
Yes, it is rather interesting, said Havistock placidly. Although in modern academia, Washington Irving has fallen a bit out of favor. Marginalized, he said, happy to have come up with the word. Not a distinctly American voice, the scholars say. Bit too cosmopolitan, too European, which is only to be expected, I suppose, as Irving learned most of his craft from Addison and Steele. At any rate, my illustrious ancestor would certainly approve of my daily routine.
Which is?
Working in libraries, reading old newspapers, studying the old government records.
Why government records? Airily he waved a hand.
They are of interest to me. And of even greater interest to a close associate of mine, who sometimes manages to turn up quite a lot of interesting information in the course of things. I believe you two are acquainted with each other.
Who is that?
Lucius Reeve?
In the ensuing silence, the babble of the crowd and the clink of glasses rose to a roar, as if a gust of wind had swept through the room.
Yes, Lucius.
Amused eyebrow. Fluty, pursed lips.
Exactly. I knew his name would not be unfamiliar to you. You sold him a very interesting chest-on-chest, as you recall.
That's right. And I'd love to buy it back if he could ever be persuaded.
Oh, I'm sure. Only he's unwilling to sell it, as,
he said, shushing me maliciously.
As I would be, too. With the other, even more interesting piece in the offing.
Well, I'm afraid he can forget all about that, I said pleasantly. My jolt at Reeve's name had been purely reflexive, a mindless jump from a coiled extension cord or a piece of string on the floor.
Forget? Havistock permitted himself a laugh. Oh, I don't think he will forget about it.
In reply, I smiled, but Havistock only looked more smug.
It's really very surprising. The things one can find out on the computer these days, he said.
Oh?
Well, you know, Lucius has quite recently managed to turn up some information on some other interesting pieces you've sold. In fact, I don't think the buyers know quite how interesting they are.